During our initial investigation, we found no ties to terrorism.
Details emerge on the Anchorage man accused of killing five people at the Fort Lauderdale Airport. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Monday, January 9th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a continuing bleak economic outlook for 2017.
We're kind of past the hard part where we had to predict when the rough times were going to start. So now we definitely can, in retrospect, identify that, you know, this really started in 2016.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating economic opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. And by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com.
Law enforcement officials in Anchorage held a press conference on Saturday regarding what's known about Esteban Santiago, the alleged shooter in Friday's attack at the Fort Lauderdale Airport. In spite of known mental health concerns, police returned a firearm to Santiago last month. FBI Special Agent Marlon Ritzman says in November of last year, Santiago came into the Bureau's Anchorage office complaining a government agency was controlling his mind and making him watch ISIS videos.
During our initial investigation, we found no ties to terrorism.
Local police laid out a detailed chronology of Santiago's contact with law enforcement over the course of the last year, beginning in January of 2016 and involving Santiago's girlfriend at their Fairview home. Four domestic violence incidents were reported to police, but only one led to an arrest. In the November incident, Santiago had what Anchorage Police Chief Chris Tolley called a mental health crisis and walked into the FBI's office with complaints of terroristic thoughts.
Santiago had a loaded magazine on him, but had left his firearm in his vehicle prior to contacting agents.
APD officers later brought Santiago to a mental health facility where he was admitted. APD also confiscated his firearm for safekeeping. But because Santiago was never adjudicated mentally ill, Tully says they later returned the weapon, which may be the one used in Friday's shooting.
There is speculation that this is the same gun. I have not received confirmation that it, in fact, is that gun.
The FBI says they believe Santiago acted alone when he planned and carried out the attack. According to U.S. District Attorney Karen Loeffler, there is no federal rule that would have prohibited Santiago from legally transporting a firearm on a commercial flight. Santiago appeared in federal court in Fort Lauderdale this morning, where a judge explained the charges and told him he could face the death penalty. Santiago told the judge he worked for a security firm in Anchorage until November and that he only has about $5 or $10 in the bank. Santiago is a decorated former member of the Puerto Rico and Alaska National Guards and was deployed to Iraq as a combat engineer from 2010 to 2011. He was given a general discharge from the Alaska National Guard in August of 2016, according to Lieutenant Colonel Candace Olmsted. Investigators haven't yet determined a motive for why Santiago flew to South Florida for the attack. In the final days of 2016, a storm caused wind and water damage to many buildings in Savunga, one of two communities on St. Lawrence Island. At one point, nearly 100 people took shelter in the school building. The community declared a local disaster and is asking for assistance from the state in order to restore their livelihoods. KNOM's Davis Hovey traveled to Savunga and has this report.
As of Friday, 30 residents are claiming damage to their homes or shelters from the storm, along with the community's teen center and the city office. Each building that suffered damage from the winter storm has to go through a damage assessment conducted by the Alaska Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management, or DHSEM. John Ramsey from the Alaska Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Management describes the criteria he's looking for when conducting a damage assessment.
We look and see if the building is number one livable or not, if it's a home, if there is any damages, what the extent of the damages is, so that we know if it's habitable or not, if there's any emergency housing that needs to be done for individuals or families at the time a disaster happens. And we basically just do a tally and see what the impact of the community is for a disaster.
Ramsey was in Tavunga back in 2011 after another storm left the community without power for a period of 4 days. Myron Kingikuk, the mayor of Tavunga, believes this latest storm caused more structural damage than the 2011 one. The storm's impact was evident as we spoke outside one damaged home.
We're at Harriet Pinaya's house right now. After the storm died down, they repaired the roof, and we just find out this attic is got damaged by water. So he tore off his whole carpet in there. So hopefully we could talk for her, and we still got to look at lots of homes.
Our crew of two DHSEM employees, two Red Cross representatives, Mayor Kingikuk, and myself walked from home to home, trying not to fall on the slick, ice-covered roads. Carl Edwards, an emergency management specialist with DHSEM, led the damage assessment by asking each homeowner, more or less, the same questions.
After the roof fell off, or came off, did you get water coming in?
Uh-huh.
Did it get any insulation wet?
I didn't go check that attic.
And have you had any electrical problems? Is the toil still working?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
It's good.
Throughout the assessment, we saw some buildings were missing chunks of siding or roofing. Others had tarps covering some openings where walls used to be, and many structures had foundation issues. One homeowner who experienced damage to his roof answered Edwards' questions with translational help from the mayor.
Any windows broken or
water cups cooked?
I mean inside. We're talking about the insulation. The water went into your house?
Yeah.
So
tell what? Those guys, not me.
Okay,
you don't speak Siberian.
During the height of the storm on New Year's weekend, when winds were reported to be gusting at more than 117 miles per hour, Tavunga School was used as a safe haven. Principal Ralph Lundquist and most of the school employees were out of town for winter break that weekend, creating a poorly supervised environment for the 93 community members staying in the temporary shelter. Disaster Program Manager for the Red Cross in Fairbanks, Michael Verrier, says the Red Cross can provide shelter management training, free of charge, to help community members in Tavunga become self-sustaining during storm disasters.
We have volunteer shelter instructors that can help give shelter training and do a shelter exercise with interested people that are within the community, so that when an event like this happens in the future, there's people within the community that are able to open the shelter, keep it safe, keep it secure as best as possible.
Verrier and his colleague from the Red Cross stayed in Tavunga until Sunday to complete their own damage assessment in conjunction with the DHSEM. Verrier says Red Cross could provide financial assistance to individuals in the community so they can repair their damages, but the Red Cross cannot buy materials directly for them. Ultimately, Tavunga is looking to the state for assistance, but Carl Edwards explains there is a limit to the needs his department can meet, so the rest of the aid would have to come from either volunteer organizations, the governor, or both.
They requested assistance from the state, from my office, to help them through the disaster process. So that entails myself and some others coming out, looking at the community, trying to total up the damage, and then we present it to the disaster policy cabinet. The disaster policy cabinet will make a recommendation to the governor, and then the governor will make the final decision as to what we're going to do for this community.
Mayor Kingikuk says he hopes this disaster declaration letter will result in his community getting the help it needs. It is unknown how long it will take for a disaster declaration letter to be submitted to the disaster policy cabinet, but Edwards assuredly says the process will be expedited. Reporting in Tavunga, I'm Davis Hovey.
President-elect Donald Trump's pick to head the Commerce Department, Wilbur Ross, is a billionaire investor, a specialist in distressed industries. If confirmed by the Senate, he'll be the face of American business. But does this New Jersey-born Floridian know anything about Alaska? Yes, according to U.S. Senator Dan Sullivan. Sullivan met with the Commerce nominee last week. The senator says he found out Ross has been to Alaska many times.
He was an investor in Ween Airlines, then Ween Airlines.
Ween, founded in Fairbanks in the 1920s, was for a time Alaska's largest airline.
And given the number of times he was up in Alaska for business, he was actually in Anchorage during the 1964 earthquake.
A New York Times article says 1964 was the year Ross went to work at a Wall Street brokerage house as an airline analyst. The Commerce Department is important to Alaska primarily because of its role in fisheries and science. The Commerce Department includes the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, the National Weather Service, and the National Marine Fisheries Service. Sullivan says he and Ross spent about half an hour discussing fisheries.
NOAA's role, Magnuson-Stevens Act, North Pacific Fisheries Council, who's in it, who's on it, personnel issues, the importance of the industry to Alaska.
Sullivan has met with several of Trump's potential cabinet members, including those chosen for the Pentagon and the EPA, as well as Commerce.
When you have a connection to a place, it matters. And the nominee for the Department of Commerce secretary has a connection to our state.
Sullivan is a member of the Senate Commerce Committee, which is scheduled to hold a confirmation hearing for Ross on Thursday. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, what the Japanese imprisonment during World War II can teach us about today.
That's impossible, Mom. The Constitution protects us because we're American citizens.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you have an opinionated teenager in your home who thrives on proving a point, check out the Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future Scholarship Competition organized by UAA's Seawolf Debate Program. More than $10,000 in prizes will be awarded. Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future gives the next generation of Alaskans a voice in the direction of our state. Contest details available at debatingakfuture.com. This message sponsored by Seawolf Debate.
Thousands of Alaskans lost their jobs in 2016, and in the forecast for 2017, it doesn't look like the economy is going to stop shrinking anytime soon. Oil prices, the foundation of the state's economy, have rebounded slightly, but not enough to balance the state's budget. A new state economic forecast predicts layoffs and job losses in nearly every sector. From Alaska's Energy Desk, Rasha McChesney has more.
State economists say cuts in the oil and gas industry, construction, and the public sector have been so deep they're causing job losses in nearly every other sector of the economy. Alaska's Department of Labor and Workforce Development economists say the state's economy is in decline, and for the first time in decades, the state's going to have to fund the majority of its budget with something other than oil revenue. But oil industry losses, the catalyst for the state's rapidly shrinking economy, are expected to slow. According to the state's employment forecast for 2017, the oil industry is still expected to shed 1,400 jobs this year, but that's about half of what it lost last year. While oil prices are the main driver for the economy, state economist Carolyn Schultz says they're relatively easy to predict. The big unknown now is political.
Legislative decisions and budget decisions made by the legislature and the governor, I mean, we don't have as good of a read on how that's all going to pan out.
Schultz says whatever the legislature decides to do this year probably won't solve all of the state's budget problems, but could go a long way toward boosting consumer confidence and encouraging new business. Sectors of the economy like arts and entertainment and recreation will see big losses in 2017 as people spend less money. And while a good tourist season will help with that loss, this year could be rough on restaurants and bars. The financial services are also expected to take a hit as real estate and demand for financing slows. And the public sector will be thinned again as well. At least 1,300 jobs were cut in 2016, and Governor Bill Walker introduced a budget in mid-December that calls for another 400 state jobs to be cut by December of 2017. There are some bright spots. The healthcare industry is expected to keep adding jobs as the state's population ages. In fact, it's the only industry forecasted to grow, adding 500 new jobs this year. And military spending is up, with nearly $550 million in new hangars, buildings, and construction contracts between Eielson and Fort Wainwright bases in Fairbanks. In Anchorage and Southeast Alaska, the tourism industry could get a boost from large numbers of out-of-state travelers, and cruise ship bookings are up. Schultz says there weren't a lot of surprises for economists when they were crunching the numbers for the 2017 forecast.
We're kind of past the hard part where we had to predict, you know, when the rough times were going to start. So now we definitely can, in retrospect, identify that, you know, really started in 2016.
She says the new excitement is to predict when the state starts to come out of this slump, but that likely won't happen in 2017. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
Lawmakers couldn't agree last year whether to permanently provide health insurance to the survivors of police officers and firefighters who die in the line of duty. Starting next week, they'll have another chance. A bill to provide survivors with insurance was among the first filed ahead of the legislative session, which starts on January 17th. Some surviving families have received state-funded insurance in recent years, but that practice isn't enshrined in state law. Representative Andy Josephson is sponsoring the bill and says filing it early makes it more likely to be enacted.
These are folks that feel duty-bound and have made them since their youth to participate in high-risk activity for the benefit of the public. And they shouldn't be asked to sacrifice health care for their families when they've made the greatest sacrifice.
Incoming House Minority Leader Charisse Millett introduced an identical bill. Other pieces of legislation filed ahead of the session include a measure by Senator Mike Dunleavy that would restore full funding to permanent fund dividends and make another PFD payment of about $1,000. And Senator Bill Willikowski is seeking to add dividend payments to the state constitution. Another of Willikowski's bills would punish lawmakers who fail to pass a state budget within the first 90 days of the session by denying them salaries and per diem. And Representative Matt Klayman introduced a constitutional amendment to limit the session to 90 days. While state law says sessions last 90 days, the Constitution sets the limit at 121 days. Josephson also introduced a bill to prohibit the state or municipalities from helping the federal government create a registry based on people's race or religion. He says he's concerned that President-elect Donald Trump will seek to register Muslims and deport unauthorized immigrants based on their race.
So my view is this is one of those important moments where somebody has to say, no, that is not what we're going to do.
Another round of pre-filed bills will be released on Friday. The Perseverance Theater production of Hold These Truths is playing in Anchorage this week. The one-man show tells the story of Gordon Hirabayashi and his resistance of the forced imprisonment of Japanese Americans during World War II. As Alaska Public Media's Ann Hillman learned, the historical play is very relevant today.
I take an elevator to the top of the Empire State Building.
Actor Greg Watanabe jumps on a crate, rehearsing a scene where Gordon Hirabayashi takes a trip to New York City.
I have this feeling like a great weight lifting off of my chest. Feeling a new surge of endless possibilities. Feeling like I've finally joined the human race.
Watanabe explains that Hirabayashi grew up in Seattle during the 1920s and 30s, when racism against Japanese Americans was rampant.
Anywhere where there were Japanese American communities, there was a lot of nativist rhetoric that came out that said that these people will never assimilate. These people are, they're going to destroy our race, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. That stuff was happening for decades before Pearl Harbor happens.
Watanabe and his director, Leslie Ishii, say the story of the Japanese imprisonment, often called internment, has relevance today when political leaders are calling for a Muslim registry and Islamophobia is on the rise.
We see that same kind of nativist language being used about immigrant communities and about Muslim and Arab communities. Mm-hmm. So I think that for Japanese Americans, we understand that there's real danger in that.
Japanese Americans across the country are speaking out in support of the Muslim and Arab American communities and their constitutional rights. Hold These Truths profiles Gordon Hirabayashi and how he fought against the Japanese imprisonment. At first, he thought the government couldn't forcibly relocate his generation of Japanese Americans because they were citizens. Here, Watanabe acts out a conversation between Hirabayashi and his mother at the start of World War II.
Mom, shinpai shinaide yo. Don't worry. If they try to do anything to you, you know that I'll be here to help you. Daijoubu. Nani itturu no? What are you talking about? If they do anything to the Ise, they will do the same thing to you, Nise. That's impossible, Mom. The Constitution protects us because we're American citizens.
But when President Roosevelt handed down Executive Order 9066, it applied to everyone of Japanese ancestry, no matter what their citizenship. Hirabayashi defied both a nightly curfew for Japanese Americans and the evacuation order. He battled his convictions all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court and lost. Hirabayashi and others served some jail time. Then, in the 1980s...
The convictions were vacated, but they weren't. They didn't actually say Executive 9066 violated their constitutional rights.
Director Ishii says it's a necessary time to present the decade-old play because it serves as a reminder of how history can repeat itself unless different communities begin to unite.
We can forward the message that this is absolutely unjust, and the damage, the trauma that occurs is deep and takes generations to heal from.
Hold These Truths will play in Anchorage through January 15th. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
the 2017 statewide VP Teachers of Excellence Program. Teacher nomination forms available at vpteachers.com.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
Recent heavy snows and high winds have created avalanche conditions in areas of the interior not normally prone to slides. Alaska Avalanche Information Center Education Director Forecaster Sarah Carter warns of a wind-consolidated slab.
A cohesive chunk of snow on top of something that's less dense, and that's the recipe for a slab avalanche if you put it on steep terrain.
Such conditions are common in the mountains, but Carter says the recent weather has extended slide potential into forested hills as well.
It's less likely because those trees act as anchors to hold the snow in place, but they can also be trigger points, places where the snow is a little bit weaker.
Carter cautions of hillsides 30 degrees or steeper, noting that even short hills can trigger release of enough snow to bury a person, especially when it's deposited in a creek bed or other terrain trap. She says common indicators of avalanche potential include shooting cracks and the sound of settling snow. Lonnie Dupree has called it quits on Mount Hunter after a harrowing experience. The Minnesota-based adventurer began an attempt last week to become the first person to scale the 14,500-foot Alaska Range peak alone in January. In an online post this morning, Dupree says he was flown off the mountain after surviving a crevasse fall. Dupree says he broke through snow and it took a great deal of time and effort to extract himself. Dupree says the mishap occurred while he was descending after he failed to find a safe route up the mountain. Citing unstable snow as well as high winds and extreme cold, Dupree says he decided to abandon the climb, noting it has provided experience and knowledge for future attempts. It took Dupree 4 attempts over 5 years to make the first successful solo January ascent of Denali in 2015. Whale Pass residents voted to become a second-class city in an election that is wrapping up. The small community has about 50 residents on northern Prince of Wales Island. KFSK's Angela Denning reports.
It was a mail-in election, and ballots had to be postmarked by January 3rd. While there could still be a few ballots coming in, most of them have been counted. Unofficial results show about 80% of voters support incorporating Whale Pass. The new second-class city will encompass about 26 square miles of land and water. The new municipality will have one paid employee, a city clerk, and will be governed by a 7-member city council, which voters also chose during the election.
I think it'll bring some organization to the community and it will help increase revenue.
That's Daryl Donaldson, one of the candidates voted onto the council. He's lived in Whale Pass for 17 years and would like to see it grow.
Oh, I'd like to see improved harbor facilities, improved facilities for our library and community hall, a little better fire protection, kind of the whole gamut of public services, better road maintenance, things like that.
Second-class cities are not obligated by law to provide any particular service, but supporters like Donaldson hope that's just what Whale Pass will do. The town had a nonprofit community association, but Donaldson says the services it provided were limited and relied on volunteers.
I think as an incorporated community, we can go a little bit further with those services.
But not all voters supported Whale Pass moving to a city status. Resident Sharon Hillis voted against it.
I don't think we need it. I think that everything's about money.
Hillis believes in the election process, and her home was a local drop-off point for ballots. But she says she doesn't think incorporation will bring in funding from grants in the state like some residents think it will.
With the state being in such difficult financial times, that they will discontinue some, if not all, of the money they give to cities because they're already cutting important services like the state troopers and education, and I can't see where giving money to a second-class city is going to remain a priority.
And she worries taxes will come into play to help pay for the city. Hillis and her husband have lived in Whale Pass for nearly 30 years. They moved there so he could build roads for logging, which was active back then. She says the community has changed a lot in that time. Most of the original families are gone.
It's just a different mindset now. People think they need to be taken care of now instead of dealing with things themselves.
The community relies on small airplane service for supplies and mail. It's connected to the Prince of Wales Island road system, but it's a long drive from some of the larger towns on the island. Donaldson believes Whale Pass will retain its small, remote charm, even as a city.
It's a small community that cares for each other, and it's a beautiful place to live. It's got access to all the outdoor living things that Southeast Alaskans enjoy. It's just kind of a neat place.
The election results are scheduled to be certified around January 19th. When that's done, Whale Pass will become the 116th second-class city in Alaska. In Petersburg, I'm Angela Denning.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found at our website, alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Andrew Kitchenman and Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Davis Hovey in Nome, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Ann Hillman and Zachariah Hughes in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Angela Denning in Petersburg. Our audio engineer is Eric Bork, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, with over 13,000 ATMs and more than 6,000 branches coast to coast. For a branch location near you, visit wellsfargo.com. If you're a rural Alaska resident with an interest in preserving subsistence hunting, trapping, and fishing for future generations, consider applying for a seat on a Federal Subsistence Regional Advisory Council. Deadline is Friday, February 3rd, 2017. More at 1-800-478-1456 or email subsistence@fws.gov. This message sponsored by your Federal Subsistence Board and the U.S. Departments of the Interior and Agriculture. Support for Alaska Public Media's Energy News Desk comes from Bettisworth North, Architects and Planners, and the Atwood Foundation.
The University of Alaska Southeast is open for business to all Alaskans. 2017 is your year to finish a degree and increase your earning power with online courses in business, accounting, and management. Explore the options online at uas.alaska.edu/SOM. This message sponsored by UAS.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.